Well, let's get started. Welcome to our physics seminar series. We have a few changes coming up. Tom DeLillo and our speaker on theoretical high energy physics about the impact of there's no Higgs discovered is actually going to switch places. So Tom will go on November 2nd, and Ed Berger from Argonne National Lab will come on November 9th. So keep that in mind. Just a switch because he didn't know he had a major theoretical conference at Argonne that week. Our speaker today is actually a local native of Western Kansas and now teaching at the Department of Physics at Fort Hays State University. Did a lot of research on his PhD on light damage to tissues, and he's going to talk to us today about understanding the dangers of blue light thermal damage models. Professor C.D. Clark.
Thanks for inviting me down here to visit. As Nick said, I'm originally from Southwest Kansas, so I'm from Haviland, which probably nobody here has heard of. I talked to a student here just a minute ago about it. It's a small town on 54, which I think you guys call Kellogg in town, right? You drive 54, an hour and a half west, you run into Haviland, it's on the other side of Pratt. There were 700 people in the town. My high school was like 80 students. I went to Fort Hays State University, graduated in 2004, and until then, that was the largest city that I had ever lived in, and so Wichita was the city that I had been to, you know, before I graduated from Fort Hays State. Then I moved to San Antonio, which was 1.35 million people, and had a rude awakening on what the actual city is like. So it's good being back in Kansas. It's good being back in this part of the state. I'm going to talk about understanding the dangers of blue light, and by really the part of it being blue light is just the short wavelength region of the visible spectrum where the photon energies are high enough to actually cause photochemical reactions directly in biological tissue. And talk about the interaction between thermal and photochemical damage mechanisms and how we model the damage that is caused by blue laser light. So a general overview, I'm going to talk first just state the general problem in terms of trying to predict whether or not a laser exposure to the eye is going to cause damage to the retina. Talk about the motivation about why we would want to try to, first of all, understand this, and second of all, predict with either computational simulations or actual model equations to describe the damage process. Talk about general walkthrough of all of the steps that you have to consider if you're going to try to address the hazards of laser light in the retina. And then I'll focus on the piece of the details of the talk are going to be in this fourth bullet here where we are talking about the actual damage models. Once light has reached the retina, how does it interact with the retina and how do we predict whether or not we would actually cause a lesion or a burn? That goes into a new model that that addresses some unexplained experimental results that were collected over the last couple years, and then I'll go into my conclusions. All right, so a general statement of the problem, right? We know that the eye is basically an optic system. We have an exposure to the cornea. We can measure all of this directly. We want to know what happens to the retina when it is viewing this light source, right? None of this stuff can be measured directly, so we have to predict, one, what the light source looks like at the retina, and two, how does it interact with the retina. So motivation, of course, my main motivation for the group that I worked with while I was in graduate school was this third bullet here, safety. But, the most fundamental motivation is just demonstrating an understanding of how these underlying mechanisms work as far as how does light interact with biological tissue to lead to damage, right? As a scientist, that's just an interesting question. But we also need to understand these mechanisms in order to supplement any experimental data that's been collected so that, in the lab, they are limited by what wavelengths they can actually produce. They're limited by the number of exposure configurations that they can set up and do in a given amount of time. So really the theory and modeling part is provides a nice supplement to experiments that will be done. The safety motivation is one, you know, the laser safety standards, if you see, you know, these laser damage, or the, excuse me, these laser hazard warnings, right, all of these laser pointers now have a badge on it where the ANSI standard Z136.1 governs the safe use of lasers. And we really want, you know, we don't want the standards to be simply, okay, all laser light is hazardous, therefore we shouldn't allow any laser light, right? But we don't want the standards to be so relaxed that we can find ourselves in potential dangerous situations. If the safety standard is too low, it makes actually doing experiments with lasers sort of inhibitive. Also, if we understand the mechanisms, we could provide some sort of protection mechanism. If we know how damage is being done, then we're interested in how do we prevent damage. But there's the obvious medical applications, which is, you know, using lasers in surgery. In that case, you're wanting to cause damage in a specific region without causing collateral damage, or if you want to do some sort of laser therapy, you're wanting to do sub-threshold stimulation of a tissue. So basically, we have our schematic of the eye, right? A laser light comes in from the left. Looks like that shows the appropriate color for today's talk. I have a green laser pointer. I have a green laser cartoon. Right, the cornea does most of the focusing of the laser light. The lens does the additional focusing. Basically, you have an optics, you know, a lens that focuses the laser light. Then you have beam propagation going on through the vitreous. And for certain wavelengths, which I won't talk about today, but I'll just make you aware of it, you can actually have some beam propagation effects where you have to consider the fact that you have a wave propagating through a media whose refractive index could depend on the temperature. So that's the propagation step. Once you get to the retina, you need to understand how does the retina absorb the light energy, what sort of temperature rise does that cause? It's the most common hazardous side effect of a high intensity light source being focused on the retina. You generate some temperature rise in the retina, which then can lead to a burn, which is observed as a lesion on the retina. So this would be an example of taking a picture of somebody who has an actual lesion that's observable on their retina. So my work that I spent most of my graduate career working on is understanding the sort of the different parts that I just discussed. One, how does a beam propagate through the vitreous? So I did some work on propagation when you have to include thermal lensing. This is when in the near infrared you can cause a lens internal to the eye by heating up essentially the water, the vitreous humor, which then affects the beam propagation during the exposure. So if you want to be able to predict what the exposure to the retina is, you need to consider the fact that the refractive index is changing as a function of temperature, which makes it a function of time. How do ultra-short pulses propagate through the eye and affect the exposure to the retina? I also did work on considering multiple or repetitive pulse exposures and how that would affect the safety standard. But today I'm going to talk about rate process models, which are used to describe thermal damage. And until recently we proposed a rate process model to also interact with the photochemical damage part. And I'll go into a little more detail about what I mean by thermal damage and photochemical damage. So the first step is the experiments that I was trying to describe were actually done in cell culture. Okay, so if you look at the in vivo system, which is called, right, an actual laser exposure to the eye, you have all of this stuff in front of the retina that can affect what your beam diameter looks like, what your beam shape looks like, right? There's a lot of stuff that happens between the cornea and the retina. Simplify this, we can grow retina cells, right, cells that are found in the retina layer of the human eye, on plates and do laser exposures to them directly and consider how much power does it take to actually kill a plate of cells that are exposed to lasers. In this case, we have a small amount of media, but this really allows us to characterize what the exposure to the cells was. And we can also replicate this cell line much faster. I mean, we don't and we don't have to actually have an entire eye to do the experiment on. We can do a lot more experiments with just cell culture. So the experiment that I am going to be trying to model is actually doing laser exposures to cell culture. And as a good physicist, I will assume that this is approximately equal to the extremely complex case, which is the actual eye. Right? This is the chicken is approximately a sphere type of deal. All right, so how do we predict the temperature that these cells that are exposed to laser are going to experience? Well, it's all basically governed by the heat equation. We have a small amount of buffer that sits on top of the cell layer, right? This buffer is essentially water with some salt in it. It has basically the same thermal properties of water. And for this wavelength that we'll be considering, this one's green, but we'll talk about blue light. This buffer is basically transparent. The cells are going to absorb laser energy, and they're going to turn that into heat. So they're going to get a temperature rise. And then if we want to be able to understand how does this heat propagate away from the exposure site and into the buffer, right? This is all basically given by the heat equation. If I look at the energy deposition in the cell layer, if I assume linear absorption, that means I just have a exponential decay of absorbed energy as a function of depth in the cell layer. So my laser interaction is modeled as a source term to the heat equation. This is light energy that's being turned into heat that is deposited exponentially with depth in the cell layer. And then I could also consider that I have some beam profile, so I may have a non-uniform heating profile in the radial direction as well. All of this is essentially going to lead to the thing that I'm most interested in is what happens right at the center of the beam at the surface of the cell layer, because this is the point that is going to basically reach the highest temperature. And you can see just from if I have a Gaussian beam profile, right, my peak irradiance is at the center, my peak source term is at the surface of the cell layer. So if I watch the temperature right here at the center of the beam, that is the area that I expect to see damage first. Well, it turns out that the peak temperature rise is just linear with or it's linearly dependent on the incident power. So this is just a statement that I'm dealing with the heat equation, which is linear. I'm not considering any nonlinearities in the absorption coefficient. All that means is that I can write my temperature at any given time, but if I consider my peak temperature here, so this would be an example temperature profile that you would observe at this center point as a function of time. So my laser comes on, I begin heating, the laser turns off, and I immediately see cooling. If I just look at this peak temperature rise, right, that number is just going to be a linear function of my input power. Right, there's a T-naught here, which is just my baseline temperature. So if I'm looking at in vivo, then my baseline temperature is going to be the body temperature, core body temperature, 37 degrees. For the cell culture experiments, it could be just whatever the temperature of the lab is, or they actually have the ability to raise the background temperature to body temperature as well. But basically, the heat equation is going to have a solution which I can write as a linear function of the power. So all I'm trying to say here is that if I have the temperature rise, if I double the power that I put into the system, I get a temperature rise that's twice as high. If I cut the power in half, I get a temperature rise that is half as high. If I go to long exposure durations, and in this case, long is defined as a exposure duration where I've essentially reached my not equilibrium, but steady state solution, where the peak temperature rise reaches a maximum and then basically stays constant during the exposure, then I have something that looks very similar to just a square wave temperature rise profile, right? And the maximum temperature that this square wave reaches is just going to be a linear function of my input power. All right, so for damage models, thermal damage has been described for over 50 years now as just a simple chemical reaction where the product are healthy proteins and the reactant is a healthy protein and the products are unfolded proteins. So we know that the function of a protein in the cell is tied very closely to its shape. And so if you unfold a protein, you've basically disabled that protein's function. And if you unfold enough of these proteins, then the cell can no longer survive and it will end up dying, right? So the model for thermal damage is essentially that you have healthy proteins, and that's all the more detail that we get at this point. There's a lot of research going on right now to understand, well, what protein is it that is the healthy protein that's being disabled? But the general idea is that you have these healthy proteins that are folded and therefore can function, and they are being unfolded through a chemical reaction. All right, so if you have a collection of proteins, they're all traveling around at their own random direction, their own random speed. That distribution of speeds is going to be given by the Maxwell velocity distribution, right? If you consider now a collision between just two of these proteins, there will be a energy associated with the collision. So the two, if you look at just the velocity of the two proteins that are traveling towards each other, you say, okay, well, if the energy of this collision is above some activation energy, then I'm going to get an unfolding event. If it's below the activation energy, I'm not going to get an unfolding event, right? If you take the Maxwell distribution for velocities, consider this collision here, you get the famous Arrhenius rate, which is a differential equation here that basically describes the rate of chemical reaction and its dependence on temperature. So we know that for most chemical reactions, if you raise the temperature of the system, you increase the rate of the reaction. And that's what this Arrhenius rate here says. If you look at if I plot the right-hand side here, I've got temperature on the x-axis, and I've got the rate of the reaction on the y-axis. This is the characteristic of the Arrhenius rate that makes it almost look like a switch. Basically, my damage rate is non-existent until I reach some critical temperature, and then if I go above that critical temperature, it immediately takes off and becomes very large. So I go from a region of having a very low chemical reaction rate to having a very high chemical reaction rate. Well, this chemical reaction rate is what is modeled, we use to model the rate of causing damage. Okay, so damage is going to be the accumulation of unfolded proteins. That's going to be governed by a chemical reaction which has a temperature dependence, which means it's going to have an exponential rate with the temperature. If I look at the traditional view of what's happening for photochemical damage, now we're talking about, this is why I have blue light in the title of the talk, because for the lower end, for the short wavelengths in the visible spectrum, the light actually has enough energy that it can be absorbed by chromophore or some other molecule in the cell and actually induce a chemical reaction which kicks out the free radical. Right, so the idea is that if you have energetic photons below, say, 532 nanometers, this gets absorbed by something in the cell which kicks out a free radical. And now if that free radical goes on to interact with other things in the cell, then you will end up with a cell that dies, right? So you need the accumulation of these free radicals to build up enough toxic molecules in the cell that the cell will end up dying. Well, this is a simple, if you look at the rate of accumulated damage for this photochemical model, it's just a simple linear differential equation, right? You just have whatever your photon flux is, times some probability that a photon gets absorbed and creates this free radical. So now your damage rate or the damage accumulation is only dependent on the number of photons that you send. So one of the characteristics of photochemical damage that's been observed in the past is that as long as you send in the same number of photons or constant energy, it doesn't matter how long you do it. It doesn't matter if you give it over a 10-second period or a 100-second period. If you send in the photochemical damage threshold number of photons, you will cause cell death. Well, I keep saying threshold, so the definition of the damage threshold is just the, if I have a exposure configuration, so I have a given wavelength, I have a given beam diameter, and I have a exposure time, I want to know what is the minimum power required to kill the cells. What is the minimum power that will lead to cell death, which will ultimately link to a lesion in the retina. So I have a model for how the temperature rise within the cell culture is going to behave, right? I know that it's going to be a linear function of the input power. For long exposures, I basically just have a constant temperature during the exposure. So I go from some baseline temperature, I raise the temperature of the cells to some constant value for the duration of the exposure, and I have a model that describes the rate of thermal damage buildup as a function of temperature. So I can take my predicted temperature rise, plug it into the model for thermal damage, and I will have a accumulated amount of damage that corresponds to an input laser power. Okay, now this is an I almost debated on taking this slide out. I'm not going to walk through each one of these equations, right? This is just a derivation of how you would get damage threshold, right? The input power that just leads to damage from the two models that I described. One, what is the temperature rise as a function of power? Two, what is the damage accumulation for a given temperature rise? So, briefly, the two pieces of information I have are the temperature rise as a function of power and the damage as a function of temperature. Right, if I walk through this, my ultimate goal is to be able to isolate the input power in terms of all of my other variables, which just means I can now predict what is the minimum power required to cause damage for a given exposure duration. And if I plot that function, I get, here I have the exposure time, and I have on the y-axis the damage threshold. So if I plot this function, I get this something that almost looks like an exponential decay. And this is characteristic of thermal damage. And basically what it's saying is that if I have some laser power that will cause damage at 50 seconds, if I instead say I'm going to do an exposure for 100 seconds, it requires less power to do that damage, right? If I instead want to go to 25 seconds, I require a higher laser power to cause damage. If I instead look at, that was the laser power threshold as a function of exposure duration. If I instead look at the total energy of the exposure, which is just the laser power times the exposure time, right, then I get a increasing function with the exposure time. And this is basically just saying, right, that if I do an exposure for 25 seconds, it takes some amount of energy. If I do an exposure for 50 seconds, I have heat that's being conducted away from the exposure site during the exposure, so I end up having to put in more energy to cause the same amount of damage. And the reason that you'd want to look at this, right, this is not a very intuitive way for me to look at the thermal damage threshold, but the reason that you would want to look at this in this way, considering the total energy instead of the power, is because the photochemical damage threshold is just a constant number on the energy damage threshold. Right, so here are the experimental results from, you can see here, this is from 1979. So it was basically, everything was understood at this time, or so we thought. For several different wavelengths, they did different exposure durations, and you see that for short exposure durations, the damage threshold goes up. This is the threshold radiant exposure, or total energy. The damage threshold goes up with exposure duration until you reach 100 seconds to 1,000 seconds, and then these wavelengths flatten out. So this is the characteristic that identifies photochemical damage occurring, right? Remember, photochemical damage just depends on the total number of photons that you send in. Total number of photons is just going to be proportional to the energy of the exposure. So for these short wavelengths, right, for all of these, it looks like 514 is included in this photochemical damage. For these short wavelengths, you reach an exposure duration where you're now just causing photochemical damage, and the only thing that matters is the total number of photons that you send into the system. Over here on the left, we've got the thermal damage region where the damage threshold increases with exposure duration. And you can see here for 580, right, you never reach the photochemical damage threshold, right, because 580 is a wavelength that is too long to cause this photochemical damage. So we're basically done, right? We got thermal damage over here on the left. If your wavelength is short enough, you get photochemical damage here on the right. That is just characterized by a flat line on the damage threshold versus exposure time. Well, recently, experiments were done in our lab at 413, so this is a short enough wavelength that photochemical damage is at play. So if we take 413 nanometers, and these experiments were done in the cell culture that I described earlier, if I look at the damage threshold as a function of exposure duration, for these long exposure durations, I have reciprocity, which is what the name that's given to this constant energy for constant energy damage threshold case is, right? The only thing that matters for these long exposures is the total number of photons that I send. So this looks like a flat line on the damage threshold graph here. But if I look to the left, right, I have increasing damage threshold, which is characteristic of thermal damage, but it goes all the way up to twice what the damage threshold is for this photochemical line. And the real question is, right, we had no way of explaining why this would happen. Right, if I look at 50 seconds, for example, I've delivered enough photons that I should see photochemical damage. Right, but I don't see photochemical damage at this low level. I can continue to increase the energy with exposure duration all the way up to twice what the photochemical damage level is and still see the characteristic of thermal damage. So something here is going on in the middle between this 60-second exposure and this 100-second exposure as to why am I not seeing photochemical damage here. It's as if the photochemical damage has been disabled. Well, if you look at what's happening for a constant energy, if you give the same amount of energies, the same number of photons, but you change the time over which you give it, right? The only two things that are different between this 100-second exposure and this 60-second exposure are one, the time of the exposure, and two, the temperature rise that you would expect to get during that exposure. So if I maintain a constant energy level, but I go to shorter and shorter and shorter times, if you look at what the power of the exposure looks like, then if I'm giving the same amount of energy in less time, I have to increase my power to do that. Well, if I increase my power, I know that my temperature rise is going to be linearly proportional to my power, so that means that I'm also going to increase the temperature rise. So our hypothesis for a new model that would explain this result, where we go to shorter times and we see the photochemical damage mechanism essentially being turned off, is that if there was some way that you could turn off the photochemical damage, right, for these short exposures, then we would expect to see this thermal damage trend continue out to 60 seconds. The only difference between the 100-second and the 60-second exposures is, one, the time, and two, the temperature rise that I expect to see. So if we could turn off the photochemical mechanism with a temperature rise, then we could explain why for 60 seconds I don't see photochemical damage, even though I've delivered enough photons to cause photochemical damage. And so that is what the model that we proposed tries to address. If I consider that, okay, I've got a bunch of photons that are incident on the cell, something in the cell absorbs one of these photons and kicks out a toxic molecule, like either a free radical or a reactive oxygen species, right? These things are known to exist in the cell naturally, but if I am absorbing extra photons and kicking out extra free radicals, that can lead to a buildup that will be toxic to the cell. But now if I consider that the cell, right, encounters these things naturally, so perhaps it has a repair process or something that gobbles up these free radicals and either disables them or turns them into something that is going to be removed by the cell later. All right, so I have the forward process of creating these free radicals, but then I have some other process in the cell that is converting these free radicals into something that is no longer harmful to the cell. Well, the forward process is still going to be mediated by just the photon flux. It's the probability of a photon getting absorbed and that photon producing a free radical. But the reverse process is going to be a chemical reaction. If it's a chemical reaction, it's going to have a temperature dependence. So if I have a negative term here for my photochemical damage buildup, which addresses a chemical reaction that is taking the toxic product and disabling it, now I have a temperature dependence in my photochemical rate that could lead to a turning off of photochemical damage. So the idea would be that you're producing these free radicals at a given rate. You're able to remove these free radicals at some rate that depends on the temperature. If enough of these free radicals build up and then are able to migrate throughout the cell, that's when you actually get cell death. So I mentioned earlier that there's a sort of a critical temperature associated with this Arrhenius rate, right? This looks like the Arrhenius rate because it is the Arrhenius rate. It's a rate that describes the, or excuse me, it's a equation that describes the rate of chemical reaction. So now I have a reverse rate that depends on the temperature. There's a critical temperature associated with that, where below this temperature, the rate is small, right? I get something that's much less than 1. Above this temperature, I immediately get something that's much larger than 1. And so this is almost acts as a on-off switch, right? If I'm below the critical temperature by a degree, I basically have 0 rate. If I go above the critical temperature by just a degree, I get an extremely high rate. So this acts as a switch where if I look at now an exposure, initially I'm raising the temperature of the system. Once I cross this critical temperature, I now have an appreciable reverse rate that can disable the photochemical damage. Then once I turn the laser exposure off, right, I drop back down below the critical temperature, but I'm not sending any photons in anymore, so I don't have to worry about a repair mechanism during this once the laser is off. Well, it turns out that if you take that differential equation and solve it and get a damage threshold out of it, you can predict the experimental trend that was observed. Right, so here I have the blue dots are the experimental points that were shown on the previous graph, and then this red line is the theoretical thermal damage trend, which goes up with exposure duration as thermal damage does. And then this green line is the new photochemical damage model that was proposed. And you can see that, yes, for long exposures, it's basically constant with exposure duration. As you go to shorter and shorter exposures, there's a point here. It's very difficult to see. It's turning up, and then it basically just breaks off. Right? And that actually is a, it's not that I just quit plotting this line here. This is the point where the temperature rise that you cause becomes too large for you to overcome the repair mechanism. If you try to send in more photons, you cause a higher temperature rise, which just increases the reverse rate, and you're never able to put in enough photons to cause photochemical damage. So if you look at the exposure profiles to the left of this transition region, your temperature rises above this critical temperature. Once you go to longer exposure durations where your power is now decreasing, you basically cause temperature rises that are below this critical temperature, and now photochemical damages can actually occur, and then that photochemical damage will set your threshold. So, again, there's always a future experiments slide, right? Basically, this model itself has been published in the Journal of Biomedical Optics. It's based on one set of experimental data. In the experimental paper, which was also published in the Journal of Biomedical Optics, we do point out that there is a trend like this that's observed in vivo, meaning the animal data that exists. This trend has been observed where the thermal damage trend goes above the photochemical damage trend. But it wasn't as large as it is in this cell culture case, and so it was really never investigated much further. So I think really the tricky part is with all of these things playing, you know, power interplaying with photon flux, interplaying with temperature rise, really the way to tease out whether or not this is a temperature-dependent rate that is happening is to do some multiple pulse exposures where now you expect thermal damage and photochemical damage to add differently. If you send half of your damage dose in a 10-second period and then you send the other half in another 10-second period, the way that you expect thermal damage and photochemical damage to add is going to be different, and you should be able to determine whether or not there's a temperature component to the photochemical damage. Of course, the conclusions are that this disconnect between the thermal and the photochemical trends that was unexplained could be explained by considering an actual temperature dependence in your photochemical part, right? So that was really the novel piece to the model, is to consider the fact that they're not completely separate processes, that we have thermal a thermal component that causes damage, but it can also interact with the photochemical mechanisms that cause damage. And of course, I've neglected a large chunk of the detailed physics when I sort of mentioned that photochemical damage is going to be your photon flux times some probability that a photon is absorbed and gets turned into a free radical. Well, there's a whole lot of physics like quantum efficiency that are going to go into that term there that could also be investigated for how does temperature affect the photochemical damage rate. Of course, I'd like to acknowledge all of the guys that I worked with. At this time, I was in San Antonio. I was working for a contractor that did bioeffects research for the Air Force Research Lab. So I had my advisor, Dr. Thomas. Dr. Denton was actually a Kansas native as well. He was from Garden City. He was the biologist that did all of these experiments. And I learned a lot more biology talking to him than I ever did taking a biology class. And then, of course, we had our lab tech guy, the guy who maintained the cell line, made sure all of the cell cultures were ready to go during the experiments, and Dr. Rockwell was also the program manager down there. That's all I have. Any questions?
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is not necessarily quantifying damage per se, it's just looking for the thresholds for either the damage model, damage cases.
Yes.
Threshold temperature changes.
Yeah, you're wanting to find the threshold that leads to damage. And actually being able to quantify, that is the end goal, which is to be able to say, well, if I know that this causes threshold, then I should be able to predict how much damage is generated below threshold, because I'm still causing these proteins to unfold, right?
But a constant times something.
Yeah. So now they're actually looking at, okay, what are the dynamics of protein folding and unfolding, and is there a way to identify exactly what protein that is being unfolded is, and can I measure the amount that gets unfolded for a given temperature so that I can actually quantitatively define my damage rate.
What model dated back to 79? Was that the thermal model? The thermal damage?
The 79 data?
Yeah.
This is Ham, so some of the very first work was done by Ham.
For threshold for thermal?
Well, this is for thermal. What they did was
damage based on wavelength?
Yeah, they did several different wavelengths, and the thermal damage was expected to increase with exposure duration. So, they basically say, this top line here is thermal only. And then photochemical damage was just identified by this reciprocity part where it becomes constant.
Just before they understood it.
Yeah, they knew that, okay, if it's photochemical, then I would expect it to depend on just the number of photons I deliver, which would give me a constant damage threshold with exposure duration, right? So this is characteristic for, it's not just laser damage to the retina, but this is characteristic in all photochemical type processes.
And how does this pertain to, for instance, LASIK surgery, which has been standardized, quote unquote, and normal everyday procedures?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me just say that the doctors do a lot of things with lasers that are great, that the physicists look at and go, wow, I can't believe they're even trying that, because we don't understand.
There's at least a certain level of a damage in certain areas.
Yeah, they are able to understand, okay, if I control my parameters like this, I know that I can cause localized damage, right?
Which will in effect give you different visions.
Which will give them the effect that they're looking for. So they're able to actually do surgery with lasers without understanding fully what the mechanisms are that do this.
Full ramifications of misuse, I guess.
Yeah. And so, that for the cornea, LASIK surgery, all that's being done right at the surface, that's not so bad.
Okay.
This modeling is going to be required for if you want to now go through the eye and do surgery at the retina. Right now you have to understand how does the light propagate through the retina? So is there some way I can condition my beam to make sure it's localized?
Yeah.
What happens when it gets to the retina? The modeling is a lot more important for trying to do laser surgery from outside the eye.
Now, are you considering also, is it purely just the heat equation as was shown in the slide, or are you considering bulk conductivity and bulk convection coefficient within the eye and things like that?
You mean actually considering fluid dynamics?
Right.
For heat transfer, the model that I'm showing is just heat transfer through solids. And it actually does very well predicting damage thresholds. Right?
It's so just assuming that the eye is such and such properties.
Yes, exactly. You can consider what happens if the conductivity changes as a function of temperature, what happens if the refractive index changes as a function of temperature, or what happens if you generate currents inside the vitreous, right? Those are higher fidelity models that end up taking a lot more computational power to consider, but yeah.
And do I lost that train crash, sorry.
How do lasers that you use in your experiment compare to like typical handheld lasers?
I don't have a lot of hands-on experience with running the experiments, but so I know that the lasers that they use are basically, sit on a table. They are several times more powerful than like the laser pointers that you get. So the warning labels on these are based on, right, this one says less than 5 milliwatts, and 5 milliwatts is like a safety standard that's defined for different wavelengths. Right, all of that data is basically based on experiments that produced curves like this. Right, so the Safety Standards Committee has considered data points that look like this in determining what is it that we can call safe for laser pointers.
The only thing comparable probably is just beam width.
Comparable?
Yeah, between the lasers used in
these. The beam diameter they're allowed, they can vary the power up and down. So the power is definitely going to be greater than 5 milliwatts, but it's the same wavelength.
Just out of curiosity, I don't know as much about the eye as I'd like, but and maybe this ties back into the other question with conductivity values and so on and so forth, but is there a good rating for absorptivity, reflectivity, transmissivity through the eye and within the eye?
They're very old data sets, and most of them were collected by, there's a group in the Army that did a bunch of, they basically did white light experiments and characterized transmission through cornea, lens, vitreous, and aqueous, I believe, is the one that's between the cornea and the lens. There's like maybe five different bulk materials that light has to go through before it reaches the retina. And that data has existed since the 70s, and some groups have also either tried to, right, there's groups that have done it for the rhesus eye, which is the human eye model, for a rabbit eye, and for human eyes. And so that data has been around for a while, which is basically just characterizing the optical properties of all of the tissues.
They basically have the entire complex index of refraction?
No, they usually measure just the absorption coefficient. The index of refraction, the real part, is less well known.
Right. Okay. That would make sense.
Yeah.
Although you could do a chromic-chronic, and now you need the dielectric. Never mind.
So there have been, one piece of my dissertation was considering the effect of the real part of the refractive index being a function of temperature in the infrared, where the vitreous absorbs a lot of the light. Excuse me?
And wavelength.
Yes, we're talking about CW exposure. So if you take like 1150 for several seconds, what you do is you create a refractive index gradient in the vitreous during the exposure, which leads to a dynamic lens that gets created. And it ends up being essentially a sort of protection mechanism in the near infrared. Because initially you get a small spot focused on the retina, but after, say, 10 milliseconds, it blooms into a large spot and isn't able to focus sharply on the retina. And so out in the infrared, you see the damage thresholds go up. significantly with wavelength.
The temperature threshold for damage, or both damage cases, that is a delta T above body temperature?
That's usually what people like to try to say, if you go above this temperature. That Arrhenius rate basically means that it has to go above some temperature for a given amount of time.
An absolute temperature?
Yeah, it's in Kelvin.
Okay.
So it's the critical temperature that's usually associated with the retina, right? If you have your Arrhenius rate parameters, it's on the order of like 54, 55 degrees or something like that. Which means that if you go above 55, you're not going to cause, you don't necessarily always cause damage, but you cause it pretty fast. Right, so if you get up to 55, you have a pretty good chance of causing damage in a short period of time. But you can cause damage at 48 degrees if you keep it there for several seconds.
Further topics of discussions, questions?
Do you know of any research for shorter wavelengths?
Shorter wavelengths don't actually penetrate to the retina, so yeah. If you go past UV, mostly the hazard there is in the cornea and the lens.
Okay.
And I don't know of any active research. I know that there's a handbook on laser safety written by Dr. Sliney that covers the hazard of UV. And I think that's all. I mean, as far as safety goes, that's all pretty much understood because all the interaction happens at the surface of the cornea. It's not until you get into the visible spectrum, so above, say, 400, where you get significant energy that can actually reach the retina and cause damage.
Let's thank our speaker again. The next speaker is actually going to be Tom DeLillo on November 2nd instead of Ed Berger, who switched with Tom DeLillo and is now coming on November 9th. So keep that in mind. See you next week.